Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each day we bring you a passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength, insight, and wisdom in everyday life. Each one of these passages is based on the 2,000-year-old philosophy that has guided some of history's greatest men and women. For more, you can visit us at dailystoic.com. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. I feel like we've talked about this a lot of times, but Stoicism isn't just an individualistic philosophy. The idea is it is a collective philosophy. We think about not just how our actions impact other people, but what we owe other people and how we orient our actions and our lives around that. In Meditations, Marcus Aurelius says what's bad for the hive is bad for the bee. He talks about the common good dozens and dozens of times in Meditations for a reason. It was the guiding idea of his life, his North Star, as a leader, as the emperor, but also as a Stoic. And this is something I'm thinking about a lot recently. I'm working on this series on the cardinal virtues, as I've told you before. I've just finished the Discipline book, which will be up for pre-order here really soon with a bunch of awesome bonuses. But as I think about this idea of justice, one of the people I've been reading and talking to a lot, because he's a friend, we've worked together on some books before, and someone who very much changed my worldview, and I like to think has made me more generous and more widened my perspective, is the one and only William McGaskill. Will is an associate professor of philosophy at the University of Oxford, and one of the pioneers of the effective altruism movement, which I actually think is very aligned with Stoicism, because the Stoics were not just concerned with the common good, but they were also concerned with rationality and reason. They would have looked not just to emote and want to help people in the abstract, but they'd want to look at how to help people and how to help them most effectively, how to have the biggest difference. I really liked Will's first book, Doing Good Better, but his new book is absolutely fantastic, What We Owe the Future. And What We Owe the Future is really about this concept of long-termism, which I think is an important breakthrough as we think about doing good, as we think about altruism, as we think about Stoicism. It's not just how do we do good for the people around us, but how do we do good for the people in the future, people we will never meet. So you could argue Marcus Aurelius is very concerned with the common good, but he fails the common good, long-termism, in a way that Hadrian, who was much more selfish than Marcus, did not, in that Hadrian sets up a succession plan that lasts for like almost 50 years, and Marcus Aurelius hands over the empire to Commodus, who quickly drives it into a ditch. So this idea of long-termism, not just what do we owe the people around us, but how do we make decisions and actions that set up a world in the future that is better, one that we'll never, you know, actually experience. We've talked here before about that great expression that a good world is one where people plant trees in whose shade they will not know. And I think that's a really important idea here in this book. Will is a fantastic writer, a fantastic thinker. He's the co-founder of 80,000 Hours, which has sponsored the podcast before. He's one of the creators of Giving What We Can, which is a global community of effective givers. It's known for the Giving What We Can pledge, which is about donating 10% of your lifetime income to the most effective charities. I think he's had an enormous positive impact in the world, and I think you're really going to like this book. Check out What We Owe the Future. I'm actually going out this weekend to see some folks, and I'm giving away 4 of the copies. The group I'm going to see is a billionaire, a great medical professional that I know, and a tech investor, and I'm giving them this book because I think they should read it. And it's really, really important. And I'm hoping they will make a difference from using the ideas that Will talks about. So check out What We Owe the Future and enjoy this conversation with the one and only William McGaskill. You can follow him at Will McGaskill on Twitter or go to williammcgaskill.com. And again, his books are Doing Good Better and What We Owe the Future. So it seems like at the crux of effective altruism and then also the new book is this idea that we should not just care about people we'll likely never meet. I think people sort of intuitively feel sympathy for those people, but you're arguing that we should actually change our lives, our decisions, and our actions on behalf of these people that we'll never meet, whether they live in a war-torn country on a different continent, or if they're 3 generations from being born.
Absolutely. So effective altruism is about trying to figure out how can we do as much good as possible and then actually putting it into practice. So changing our careers to have more social impact or donating some of our earnings in order to spend that money on whatever the most effective nonprofits are.
But I think people would say, shouldn't I care more about people that are around me, around my own family, people that are like me? Why should I be prioritizing even 1 minute of my own pleasure now for someone that, again, essentially doesn't even exist to me?
Well, I think I could give you a lot of arguments. I think the first thing is just almost certainly you do care. So Peter Singer gives this very influential argument. But just imagine you're, walking past a shallow pond and you see a child who's in that pond and they're face down. They're going to die. They're going to drown unless you reach in and save them. You'll have to run in. You'll ruin your suit. Your suit costs thousands of dollars. You're on the way to an interview, let's say. Now, if you just walked by and let the child drown, I think you and I and everyone would agree that you'd be a total asshole. And people don't want to be an asshole. They want to be good people. And that means that, we would save that child, even if it cost us many thousands of dollars. And now it turns out, the world we live in, that you can save a child on the other side of the world. You can protect them against from dying from malaria, such that statistically you will save that child's life for just a few thousand dollars. And given that, given that you can do that, I think it just follows from the values that most of us have, the large majority of us have, that that's a better way to live a life.
Have you read Camus' The Fall?
I have not read that book.
It opens with this story. The guy is walking along the streets of Amsterdam and he hears someone go into the water, whether it's a fall or a suicide. And he convinces himself that he doesn't hear it, right? That, it was nothing. Yeah. But he comes to find out that someone did die because of his indifference or the rationalization in his head. And basically, the rest of the novel, he's sort of haunted by this idea. I would agree, we should care. It's just easier to not care when it's out of sight, out of mind, which is kind of what the trauma or the indifference we have towards either the trauma we inflict on or the indifference we have about what's going to happen in the future. There's a kind of all be gone, you'll be gone-ness to it.
Exactly. So effective altruism in general is often about bringing what's out of sight and therefore out of mind, making it more salient, putting it in front of your eyes and saying, okay, you can't ignore this. And so that's true for people, the plight of people in other countries who, you may never interact with or meet, the thousands of children die of malaria every day. It's also true, as I argue in my book, What We Owe the Future, for the people who are yet to come.
Sure.
The generations of people who are going to follow us. They just have, they have moral worth, they have moral standing in just the same way that people alive today have. But we don't pay them much attention, or barely any attention at all, because they're not around to lobby for their interests. They don't get a vote, they can't tweet, they can't write articles. And I'm, you know, trying to take one step towards correcting that.
Well, there's kind of a hollowness to the whataboutism. So, right, if you're like, hey, no, you should try to find out a way to donate some of your excess money to save people who are dying of malaria, or you should invest or work in such a way that you help people in the future. And someone goes, but what about all the suffering that's happening around me right now? But the truth is, you're not doing anything about that either, right? It's a way to, I think what we often do is we go like, bad thing happening over here. Let me find another bad thing that cancels it out, right? This isn't exactly an equivalency, but people will do this. Like if someone points out, you know, sort of like violence against minorities by the police, they'll say something like, but what about black on black crime? As if pointing out another bad thing, you're essentially trying to find a way to not have to care and thus not have to do anything about it, about either of them.
Absolutely. So if someone, you know, makes the argument, we should care about people in our own communities to me, and they're like, you know, they're giving 50% of their income to this stuff, they've devoted their career, they're helping the homeless, they're helping like the incarcerated or like criminal justice reform, I'm just like, go you. I'm like, you're a fucking legend. Keep doing your thing. This is, I'm like, you know, the thing we're opposing with effective altruism is not ineffective altruism, it's just apathy, where most people don't even try to do good in the world. And we want to inspire people to do more.
No, that's a really interesting point, because there is a way where you use effective altruism and you say, here's all the things people are doing. And this thing that you care about, volunteering at this soup kitchen with your church, is actually, you know, number 700 on the list of making a positive difference in the world. Therefore, you shouldn't be doing it. That's not what that would be to misuse effective altruism. What I think the most compelling argument for it is, actually, do you, the person who's not doing anything, understand how easily and cheaply you could do something? You don't even have to get up your ass and go to a soup kitchen. You can give $10 and you know, save 1/10 of a life or whatever it is.
Absolutely. And the vast majority of people that we're convincing are not people who are already invested in some particular cause and then gave that up to switch. Happens occasionally, but much more often it's people who weren't really doing anything. Often they felt like they weren't really being spoken to by existing kind of nonprofit messaging, or they were just early on in their life figuring out what to do with the rest of their life. And yeah, we're being inspiring for them. And for sure, you know, I can give arguments for thinking that you're good, you can do more good by focusing your charity overseas or by focusing it on some of the issues that will impact the long run trajectory of the human race. But like I say, if you're just out there like on the streets helping people, that's, you're already doing like far more than, you know, most people in the world, and I absolutely commend you.
Yeah, I think one of the things that prevents people is the totality of the problems facing human beings seems so enormously overwhelming that they don't know exactly where to start. And I think one of the things that I've taken from effective altruism is that, like, actually, here's a list of things you can do to start and make a tangible. I think it may have been in that New Yorker profile of you, and it may have been you that you were talking about how, hey, if I donate X amount, you know, over the course of my life, even just if I'm making $50,000 a year and I donate 10% of that, you know, over the course of a life, I might save 1,000 human beings who otherwise would have died. And that effectively makes you like a superhero, like to save 1,000 people. Like when you hear about someone like Schindler, who saves these Jews from the Holocaust, you know, how many people did he personally save? It was a lot, but it wasn't a million, right? It was the amount that a human being with a small amount of discretionary income could potentially do over the course of their life with some of these ideas.
That's absolutely right. Like, I remember when I was younger, my brother was 17 and we were surfing on the coast in the UK. And a woman got taken out by a riptide, and he ran into the water and he like saved that woman's life. And that, just put aside ethics and morality, like, that's one of the, like, you know, big moments in the course of his life.
Sure.
Like, that was a big deal, like, in our local community. Exactly, yeah.
If he does nothing else, that's a pretty good life.
Yeah, and it's not like he talks about it a lot, but I'm sure for him, it will have been something that, like, has stayed with him and, like, made his life more meaningful. Now imagine if you did that, like, every week, like, oh, the next month, this, like, save someone from, like, sure, fire, third month, it's like a Heimlich maneuver. You know, you'd think, like, wow, I'm just this kind of, in this special situation, like, there's literally something special going on. But you really can be like that person, where, yeah, it's a few thousand dollars to save a life. You can, depending on exactly what you're earning and how much you're able to give, you really can be saving a life, you know, every single year of your life. So you can be, you know, like that person saving someone from drowning every single year. And look, I mean, again, like, put the moral arguments to the side. That's I know, that's cool. That's inspiring. That's living a life in accordance with the values we all have.
I had John Mackey on the podcast, and we were talking about the story of the boy and the starfish. Do you know this story?
I know it well. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, basically the moral is, like, you know, there's a thousand starfish on the beach. You throw one back. Someone says, what does it matter? It's just one starfish. And he says, it matters to the starfish. I think that's something that we kind of miss when we think about these things. Like, okay, so your brother saves one person, but think about what that matters to that person. Or if you save one person from dying of malaria, not just what does that matter to that person, but what does it matter to that person's family? And that is the interesting thing when they look at, like, again, someone like Schindler, when they look at what those, like, once you get a big enough sample, you get, like, okay, this person saved 500 people from certain death. It's almost a statistical certainty that some of those 500 people will go on to have a pretty large impact, right? One of them will be a professional athlete. One of them will have 10 children. One of them will discover a cure for this or that. Once you get those numbers big enough, all of a sudden you can have, like, more than just a tiny ripple, you know, in the future of the world. You could have a potentially enormous impact. I just read, David McCullough's book, Night of the Johnstown Flood. I don't know if you've read this, but there's this boy who's rescued out of the flooding. It's this horrible natural disaster, a dam burst. Anyways, I'm just reading about one of the characters, and I Google him after. This, like, five-year-old boy who's pulled from the wreckage goes on to discover the cure for some tropical disease that saves, you know, millions of lives, right? I think maybe it was leprosy. I forget what it was. But the point is, you also can't underestimate the impact that the person you have an impact can go on to have.
Yeah, absolutely. If you think that the trajectory of human civilization is positive, which I do, and I think we have strong reasons to think so, then just, yeah, every time you're saving a life, every time you're doing a good thing, you're not only helping that person, but all of the good things that they go on to do, which then have impacts of them of their own. And so you actually have an impact that just, I mean, maybe you don't know exactly what it is, but it propagates, you know, potentially indefinitely, for the very long time indeed. And this framing of, you know, you mentioned, like, there's a lot of kind of doomerism or just focus on, like, how bad and big the problems are, and it's overwhelming. And when thinking about this podcast, I had a thought of, in this way, effective altruism is a little bit like stoicism applied to the world as a whole, like, altruistically, because one important lesson from stoicism is, like, suppose something's bad is happening, going to happen to you, but there's nothing you can do to change it, then it's just neutral. Like, that is now just part of the background of the world. And, like, you should be focusing on the things that you can, where you can actually make a difference. And one thing I've certainly found before I started thinking about effective altruism, to then engage with, you know, people trying to make the world a better place and figuring out what should I do, is there's just a huge amount of doomerism, a huge amount of, like, these problems are so bad, we should feel really guilty, like, let's all get together and feel horrible. But like, that's just not helping anybody. What we want to do is make the world better and like die such that we have contributed to the world being a better place in virtue of our existence. And yeah, there is enormous amount of suffering in the world. The world is extremely unjust. That doesn't mean that the right thing to do is to like self-flagellate every day about how bad it is. Like, sure, you can have those moments and that can be important, but the primary thing is just, what are you doing to try and actually make it better? And that's what I really try and focus on.
Well, General James Mattis, the former Secretary of Defense and student of the Stoics, he had this great line that I heard. He said, cynicism is cowardice, right? So when you say that it's impossible, that you can't do anything about it, that when you give in to the doomerism, yes, you're sort of punishing yourself and that you're feeling sad, but you're also freeing yourself in that you're saying, it's hopeless, it's not on me, I don't have to do. Yeah, you're freeing absolutely. Yourself from the obligation of having to try to chip away at it, still potentially having your heart broken, but like you're exempting yourself from the solution. Like, I think about this with the people. I know some people are like, we're so worried about climate change, we don't want to contribute to the problem, so we're not going to have kids. Right.
Yeah.
And I think about that because that's precisely who should be having kids. Right. Because like the other side, the people who don't care about climate change, they're just procreating like crazy. Right. They don't care. You need more people on your team, so to speak, like because you're conscientious, because you feel about it, because you think that it matters, you should be engaged. And so when we go like, oh, yeah, it's hopeless, I'm not going to do anything about it, you're essentially seeding the field to the forces that you are saying are bad or evil.
Absolutely. And I talk about this very issue of having kids in the book, where there is this idea from the climate community of, oh, it's bad to have kids because of the negative impact they'll have. But that's so one-sided. So here's a couple of thoughts. One is just like, if you can offset your kid.
Yeah.
Well, in the UK, total emissions are like 7 tons per person per year. In the US, it's a little higher, maybe like 15. It costs at the current margin, like $1 to offset 1 ton of CO2. If you're focused on the very most effective nonprofits, let's say it's like $10. Now, kids cost a lot, like $10,000 a year would be about the typical, probably more. So, okay, let's say you add on $1,000 on the very most targeted climate nonprofits, you've more than not outdone the climate impact. But even putting that to the side, just you need to look at the positive effects that kids will have as well. And if you bring them up well, they will innovate. Perhaps they'll innovate in clean energy. They will contribute to society. They will vote for, if you bring them up well, they will be moral change makers as well. And again, unless you think the world would be better if there were no one on it at all, it's a pretty dark view and a view that I think is well justified. Then you've got to think that like humans are net good. Like, yes, we cause a lot of harm, but we also make the world better as well. And for any ethical decision, you've got to look at both sides of the ledger.
What I liked about the new book, which is called What We Owe the Future, it's essentially you're doing a very Stoic thing, which is you're saying you have to zoom out, right? You have to get a big, like that our immediate human perspective is too limited and too biased towards what's happening around you right now. And you need to take what they call Plato's view, which is, you know, we call this the 10,000 foot view. But you think about it even like in the ancient world, like did anyone ever even see Rome? Like how hard would it have been to see Rome, right? Maybe you could get on top of one mountain, but you couldn't really see all of it. Like the perspective that we get when we get up in an airplane or a spaceship, these are like relatively new modern perspectives, like maybe 100 years tops have we been able to do this. And we as human beings have to not just get that perspective to see like, hey, this border between America and Mexico is a fucking bullshit made up thing. And that there's human beings on either side of it and we should care about both. But then as you're saying, which is like human beings today, like you have a good analogy in the book. You're like, if you leave a glass bottle on the ground and it breaks, you would feel bad if your child cut their finger on it. But why should you feel less bad knowing that a child 100 years from now broke their finger on it. It's the same thing. You have to zoom out and get this bigger perspective so you can know what to do and what not to do and what to care about and not to care about.
Absolutely. And I mean, in support of your idea that this is a Stoic view, I could quote Marcus Aurelius at you if you're interested.
By all means.
Of course. So he says, "You have the power to strip away many superfluous troubles located wholly in your judgment and to possess a large room for yourself, embracing in thought the whole cosmos, to consider everlasting time, to think of the rapid change in the parts of each thing, of how short it is from birth until dissolution, and how the void before birth and the after dissolution are equally infinite." So Marcus Aurelius himself was a long-termist. Seneca was too. I have a great quote from him. But yeah, exactly. Appreciate your place. I mean, there's actually a kind of striking thing because it goes both ways. People often argue, like, look at everything that happens in your life. And what we know from modern science is that this is just this, you know, the 80 years you might live, it's a vanishing fraction of, you know, 14 billion years behind us, hundreds of trillions of years till the last stars burn out. Everything that happens on Earth is just this tiny pinprick of a pinprick. And people feel, wow, that's so humbling. And I think that's absolutely right. But it's actually also inspiring in the sense that I think our actions can have truly cosmic significance. Because it's, you know, plausible that humanity will last for hundreds of millions of years till the Earth is no longer habitable, or billions of years until, like, if we take to the stars. And then the actions we do today, I think, really could have impacts that last over that whole timeline.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are actually able to take actions like at a cosmic scale. And that is, like, you know, on the one hand, absolutely terrifying, but on another hand, you know, quite inspiring too.
I know the world is crazy and businesses are going through all different kinds of cycles, but one thing that's always consistent is that you need the best possible people in your company. And LinkedIn Jobs is here to make it easier to find the people you want to talk to faster and for free. You can create a job post in minutes on LinkedIn Jobs to reach your network and beyond to the world's largest professional network of over 800 million people. You add your job and the purple hiring frame to your LinkedIn profile, and it spreads the word that you're hiring so your network can help you find the right people for your business. Simple tools like their screening questions make it easy to focus in on candidates with the right skills and the experience so you can quickly prioritize who you'd like to interview and hire. That's why small businesses rate LinkedIn Jobs number one in delivering quality hires versus their leading competitors. LinkedIn Jobs will help you find the candidates you want to talk to faster. Did you know that every week, nearly 40 million job seekers visit LinkedIn? You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/stoic. That's linkedin.com/stoic to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your
free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's HIMS.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hardmints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan.
Well, one of the ironies of Marcus Aurelius is that he writes repeatedly in Meditations about the worthlessness of posthumous fame, right? He's like, you're saying like people in the future are going to be good too. He's like, hey, don't forget there's fucking idiots in the future too, and they suck and you don't need to perform for them, essentially. He's basically saying that like these conquerors who would try to, you know, achieve enormous things for the sake of being remembered by history, they were chasing something that didn't really matter because they weren't around to enjoy it, right? Which I think is important. Yeah. He goes, you know, Alexander the Great, like what good did conquering the world do him? He's not around. Like, it doesn't mean anything to Alexander the Great that Alexandria still exists, right? Yeah. But the irony of Marcus Aurelius is that he's writing these notes in a journal to himself, you know, not thinking of posthumous fame. And then you and I are making decisions here in the present moment, ideally for the good of other people, precisely inspired by the work that he did 2,000 years ago. And we do remember who he is. So it's this kind of paradox of like being remembered and having a grateful future doesn't do you any good. But maybe the way actually to be remembered by the future and to do good is to try to focus on what you can do now and not think about that at all.
Yeah. So I think we should distinguish between self-interest, you know, what we're doing just for ourselves, and, you know, what we're doing for the greater good in order to have a positive impact. Where, if you just care about yourself, I do believe the view that, you know, when you die, conscious experience ends, that you can't, nothing that happens after that can contribute to how well or poorly my life goes. But things I do now can contribute to how well the long-term future goes, and often in ways that will not be remembered. So, I mean, of all the scientists in the past for which modern science builds on, how many do we remember? What fraction? Sure. We know Isaac Newton, but like most people don't even know Leibniz. Like most people, you know, there's the few famous people, but all the armies of people who helped to contribute to the scientific project are, they, you know, do not get remembered, but they are having an impact because, well, it's this science, it's this cumulative project where one scientist or innovator builds on another. And this was an insight that was appreciated by Seneca. It's actually my colleague Toby Ord included this quote in The Precipice. I'll try, and it's quite long, so okay, I'll try and keep it shorter, but he says, the time will come when diligent research over long periods will bring to light things which now lie hidden. A single lifetime, even though entirely devoted to the sky, would not be enough for the investigation of so vast a subject. And so this knowledge will be unfolded only through long successive ages. There will come a time when our descendants will be amazed that we did not know things that are so plain to them. Let us be satisfied with what we have found out, and let our descendants also contribute something to the truth. Many discoveries are reserved for ages still to come, when memory of us will have been effected, and or will have been effaced. And so, in like, it's this amazing insight in like the first century AD to appreciate just like how little you knew, you know, and correctly how little you knew in first century AD. But yet, at the same time, you can contribute to this project by making a little bit of progress that the next generation will make progress on. The next generation again will make progress on, and I think that's quite inspiring, the thought that like, look, all of these benefits from past generations that have been bestowed to us, well, we can benefit the future by engaging in this intergenerational project, you know, making things a little bit better again, and then future generations can build on that even further.
What's interesting to think, like, Stoicism itself is like a 500-600 year project. Even if you cap it at Marcus Aurelius, right, and you say that it's a dead philosophy from that point forward, you know, it's like 500 years, which is an incredibly long project of many torches being passed from one generation to another that creates this thing that's still impacting people today. And so, yeah, it's like, it's humbling and also inspiring. It's like, hey, you know, it's never just one person who changes everything. It's all these sort of little contributors adding up. And then that kind of takes you down a peg, but it also should empower you that, hey, this regular person can become one of those torchbearers, and that you can have a positive impact. You can bend the arc of the moral universe, not enormously, but a little bit.
Absolutely. And this illustrates, so one of the things I talk at length about in What We Are the Future is moral progress versus kind of technological and scientific progress. Because Seneca is entirely right that you have this indefinitely long-lasting impact by contributing scientifically or through innovation. But what you're doing is like moving forward the curve of technological progress a little, or scientific progress a little bit. Because as long as there's no huge catastrophe, we don't go extinct, I think it's extremely likely that one day we will figure out everything that is possible to figure out. And so you're just making that happen faster.
Sure.
But then when we think about moral progress, it's actually very different. Like, what's the law of the universe that says that one day we have to get to the like very best moral views? I think it's much more contingent. We could end up with great moral views. We could end up with, like, you know, really dark dystopian, like fascist views. And again, thinking about the history of Stoicism, kind of, it can be illustrative there, where early millennium, first few centuries AD, like, what would you have bet on as the guiding philosophy for Western Europe, and then from there, the world? You wouldn't have bet on Christianity.
Right.
Instead, you might probably would have bet on Stoicism. But Christianity kind of won the war of ideas in Europe, and then has become, like, you know, the dominant moral worldview of the entire world. It seems to me, and like the more I learned about history over the course of the years writing this book, the moral development society has taken is really quite contingent, really could often go a different way. And I think that could continue into the future, where which moral views we promote and defend today really can shift the trajectory of the values that future generations live by.
Well, you talk about the abolition movement in the book, and I think that's interesting. I just read that book, Bury the Chains, about the creation of the abolitionist movement, that like basically a group of like seven people got in a room and were like, hey, should we care about people who are enslaved? And they came away with the answer, yes. And the entire arc of Western civilization changes as a result of that conversation, not immediately, and in many cases, not in the lifetime of those people. And they couldn't have anticipated where it would go exactly. But yeah, the moral innovation, I'm thinking about that. You have the graphic of that slave ship in the book, but there's the have you seen this, the famous drawing of the black man? And it says, am I a man and a brother? Am I not? Like, an artist comes up with an idea that represents a person that was previously, to the vast majority of, let's say, white people in the world, not seen as a human being, and renders it artistically and creatively, and you could even say propagandistically, in a way that changes how people see things. And over the course of 100, 200 years, an institution that no one would have questioned or predicted would go away does go away, and that sows the seeds for the women's rights movement and the gay rights movement and so many different movements, because a few people made a moral invention or innovation.
Absolutely. And thinking of this as a moral innovation, it is important. Like, I think that's very accurate and very surprising. I think if you just look at the history of morality. So the abolitionist movement, so for example, that symbol of, am I not a man and a brother? That was part of the fact of abolitionism being a campaign, and it was really the first moral campaign. And Adam Hochschild, who the author of this book, Bury the Chains, describes this as something never seen before in history, which is mind-blowing. Like, the idea that it was just like social activism, social campaigns, petitions were not something that had been done previously, but yet were done for the abolitionist campaign, getting hundreds of thousands of people across Great Britain to sign to come out against slavery. This was just absolutely striking. And yet, as you point out, it took time. So the first kind of public statement in the kind of course of this movement was the Germantown Memorandum in Pennsylvania from the Quakers, which were really the seed of the thought that led to the abolitionist campaign. That was in 1688. And then the abolition of slavery, not of the slave trade itself, which was earlier, but of slavery altogether in the British Empire, was 1833. And then we go all the way like to countries like Saudi Arabia and Yemen. Slavery was only abolished in the 60s. China, it was 1909. Ethiopia was in the 40s, I think. Model change takes time. We're talking about hundreds of years of campaigning, working together to bring about this change. But that is a change that I think affects potentially the entire course of future history. And the impacts there are truly enormous. Like, not just, you know, the millions of people who are being enslaved over the course of the 18th and 19th centuries, but all the people that could have followed that too.
No, that's what I think the book is so great, because you're talking about in effect, in the first book you did, you're sure talking about how can you use a little bit of your money to help some people. But the thing of like, how can I invent or come up with something or be a part of something that makes the future almost incomprehensibly better is so empowering. I just read, and I had the author on the podcast, and I won't butcher his name, but he wrote this big biography of Gandhi, and he essentially presents the idea that Gandhi invents in the way that the abolitionists invent, you know, the petition and the art and the boycott, all these different forms of social protest. Gandhi himself invents basically an alternative to warfare, right? Like, every conflict prior to that point, including, you know, the abolition movement. I mean, slavery is eradicated in America by war. You know, all conflicts were settled by violence, right? Effectively, right? Even Clausewitz says, you know, war is just the extension of politics. And for Gandhi to invent a form, passive resistance, but effectively a way of resolving conflict, changing the system without violence, with the opposite of violence, is maybe the greatest gift that humanity has ever been given, if you think about it, right? Because we have the civil rights movement to thank for that, we have the gay rights movement to thank for that. And then if you're thinking about the criteria and what we owe the future, like, try to comprehend how many people are alive today because they didn't die in wars that Gandhi's innovation prevented from happening. It's incredible.
Yeah, that's a fantastic thought experiment, and not one I'd thought about or appreciated. But this general point of, you know, we look at history and there are certain technological innovations that they're very concrete. And so you can be like, oh, and it was at this date that,
the printing press.
Gutenberg develops the printing press. In Scotland, it was always as a history of Scottish inventors. So it was always James Watt invents the steam engine. It wasn't quite true. But you've got these particular technological inventions, and it's easy because they're very concrete. But model innovation is just as important. And it's harder to, you know, it's harder to categorize. It's more intangible. And so we can overlook it. But I mean, in terms of the contribution to human well-being over the last, you know, which has been enormous over the last few hundred years, technology and scientific innovation has been absolutely huge. But so has model innovation and model progress. In 1700, 3/4 of the world were in some sort of forced labor, whether slavery or serfdom. And now that's, less than 0.5%. Maybe even considerably less. that is just incredible. Or the fact that, yeah, war between great powers was just absolutely the norm throughout, like, at least the history of times when we had large states from 1300 onwards. And now we're in a position, I mean, unfortunately, I think a war between the great powers of the world is still all too likely, but it's much less likely, I think, structurally than it used to be. And that's part of just changing norms and changing taboos. And that's, I mean, the sheer number, how many people would be alive, would not be alive today if Gandhi hadn't lived, is, that's a pretty inspiring thought experiment.
Yeah. And what, how long would it have taken? Because so many people come out of Gandhi's movement and come back to the U.S. and help lead the civil rights movement, the influence there. You know, does that change differently? Mm-hmm. Does that come as a much more violent movement instead? Does it, because of the violence, does it lose its moral high ground and thus not happen? And, you know, like it's really is like almost incomprehensible to think. And Gandhi sort of, I mean, you could trace it back to Thoreau, you know, Thoreau protests the Mexican-American War, but Gandhi discovers Thoreau after he comes up with the idea of passive resistance. But just the idea that, like, that was not a tool in people's toolkit before. Like, mm-hmm. I guess you could also, you also kind of credit the suffragettes, but just the idea that it was like before, if you were Indian and you wanted to protest British rule, your options were effectively blow them up or get another country to come wage war on your behalf and free you. Those are like your only two options, right? Or go along with an injustice. But the idea that you could morally undermine the cause until your occupier's will collapses, that just didn't exist. And it's so incredible. What an incredible gift that is, if you think about it that way.
Yeah, it's huge. And I mean, the thought is just, for all of these things, there has to have been some point at which it was new.
Yes.
So democracy too. I mean, there is a point in time where, you know, I mean, you can think of hunter-gatherer societies as democratic. They're very egalitarian, but they don't have a state. But of governments that had a state, there was some point in time which, at least in the West, was sometime before classical Athens, which was the first democracy. And then the impact of that was felt 2,000 years later, significantly via, like, you know, the Roman structure of government, which was at least at some periods of time not as authoritarian as other systems of government. Where we wouldn't have had the United States of America. We wouldn't. I mean, would we have even had this, like, flourishing of democracy where over the course of 200 years, we've gone from no one living in a democracy to 250 years, no one living in a democracy to over half the world? Again, that's due to some morally pioneering societies thousands of years ago, combined with morally pioneering individuals 250 years ago with the formation of United States. That's, like, there has to have been a first, and it's particularly impactful in the case of moral innovation, because it really might not have happened otherwise. And the same is true when then we think about moral campaigns we could be undergoing today. If we don't fight for certain rights, then it's not at all obvious that the future generations will converge on them instead.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. Well, so how do you think about the tension between your two works then? So like one argument of the effect of altruism is like, get a job on Wall Street, make as much money as you can, try to donate as much of that as you can to causes where the altruism is effective and thus has a big impact. And then, you know, your sort of 80,000 hours thought process of like, you have how many career hours do you have? What are you going to spend them on? Mm-hmm. And this idea that like, what we owe the future is moral innovation, moral effort, progress towards things that matter. What I like about the new book is it's kind of like, hey, maybe you should write a book. Maybe you should create art. You know, maybe you should found a new community or a club. How do you think about that tension then between like optimizing financially to have maximum measurable impact and then the sort of soft moral impact of like, this other stuff we're talking about?
So, I mean, the first thing I'll say is just all of this is really tough. Like I see effective altruism as this project of trying to figure out how do we do as much good as possible rather, and then like a conversation around that rather than a strict set of answers. And I mean, one thing I should say when it comes to career choice, the earning to give, go into Wall Street, donate it, was like a very powerful meme.
Yeah.
And many people did do enormous amount of good through that route. I think it's just one path among many for people. Even if you're focused on, you know, helping people in poor countries, lots of ways you can do a lot of good. But then this question of what do you focus on? Are you trying to focus ruthlessly on making the present generation better? Or are you trying to do things that are trying to make the long term go as well as possible? One thing I think is that there's less tension between those two things that you might at first think. There's enormous number of ways of doing good that have both like very good in the short run while making the long, like being very good in the long term as well. So
Sure. We
have worried about pandemics for many years. We were trying to get people to work more on pandemics and funding areas, funding places in that area since like 2014. I think if we'd had more traction, then things would have maybe gone a little better with the COVID-19 pandemic. When I look to future work to try to prevent the next pandemic, well, here, one of the things I'm really excited about is this thing called far UVC radiation, which is basically just a specific spectrum of light with sufficient intensity, and it can be fitted into a light bulb that just sterilizes a room. So it just kills off the pathogens in that room. And while hopefully being sufficiently safe for human beings as well, even with long exposure. This is like very early stage. So we're funding stuff to like research into this to see if it is as efficacious as it seems, if it's as safe as would be necessary. But let's just suppose it pans out. Well, then, and we can like really get mass uptake of this. So put into all light bulbs in all, like as a matter of regulation, like all around the world. Well, okay, sure. One thing we would have done is ensure that we never get a pandemic on the scale of COVID-19 or greater again. But along the way, we also would have eradicated all infectious diseases, or all respiratory diseases, I should say. And that's, you know, it's been good too. It's pretty good for the for the short term. Similarly, when I think about climate change and the big things we can do, best things we can do to impact climate change, a lot of it is in clean tech. So the idea of, you know, one of the most neglected things, I think, is what's called super hot rock geothermal, just digging really deep into the ground and getting heat from closer to the Earth's magma, where it's much hotter. You know, huge technical challenges there, but we should be investing in it a lot more as a society. And that's great for climate change. It's also great in the near term, not just because climate change is impacting people over the coming generation, but also just the health impacts of fossil fuel burning alone. Like 3.5 million people per year die from particulates. We can just end this. And then the same is true, I think, for model innovation and model change too. Especially in the world today, one thing that's different about today compared to history is that model change can happen much faster.
Sure.
I think it was like 11 years that gay marriage was legalized in Massachusetts, the first state, to then having being legalized federally, being a federal right, in fact. And, you know, that's just an incredible turnaround time by historical standards.
Although it's a little tenuous, right? None of these things are as stable as we'd like it to be. And that's the other... That's the other danger.
Continuous upkeep. Yeah. Of course. Absolutely. And so then, if we're advocating for new model ideals, like taking the interests of people in other countries much more seriously than people currently do, I'm a big proponent of animal rights and animal welfare and the absolute atrocity that is the 80 billion animals that are essentially tortured every year on factory farms, or the idea of caring about future generations, caring about the generations to come. This is contingent. This needn't necessarily occur. And you're right that even when we make progress, you've got to keep enforcing it because you can't get complacent. But these campaigns can often benefit people in the near term, as well as having extremely long-lasting positive effects.
That's one thing I took from the pandemic is people would try to make this argument. And I always thought, I don't think you're making the point you think you're making, which is they go like, you know, only 2,000 people a day are dying of COVID here in the US or whatever. They're like, that's way less than heart disease, car accidents, guns, et cetera. And then I'm like, wait, give me that chart again. And then you look at the chart and you're like, how are we accepting this daily holocaust of needless death? Right. And it is amazing the readiness with which human beings can accommodate and rationalize an ongoing roiling tragedy because it predates them and will probably continue past them the way we're just like, that's the way that it is. Right. Like in a sense, our reaction to COVID was the right one, which is like this thing happened and thousands of people are dying about it. We need to stop this, prevent this, and not let it become just another line on the P&L of the human race. But you can tell we've clearly done that with a number of, you know, not totally preventable human rights human issues, but like we have become very desensitized to enormous suffering and tragedy because it's a statistic.
Absolutely. We get a sense of what's normal. I mean, in the case of cars, I mean, imagine if there was a new technology. I'm like, oh, hey, it's going to help us get to work a little bit faster. It involves sending half a ton of metal at high speed around schools. And it'll kill like thousands of children and hundreds of thousands of people every year. But like it'll make the economy go faster. It would never get accepted now, but instead because it's in the past. And it's relevant when we consider something like, you know, self-driving cars, which could bring that death rate down to, you know, a tenth of what it is. People see it as like, oh, there needs to be regulation, needs to be sufficiently safe. Ethicists get into these questions of like, oh, well, what if the car could either run into one old person or five, you know, Yeah, one young person or five old people, what should the car be programmed to do? And like the moral imperative is that we get self-driving cars on the roads as quickly as possible.
Right.
As soon as they're significantly past, you know, human error rates. And why? Because literally, you know, if it's a delay of 10 years, that is millions of lives being saved.
Well, that is the other thing that COVID illustrated. You know, we get these vaccines, one of the fastest, greatest collective achievements in all of human history. And yet it almost certainly could have been faster. And certainly innovation since it could have been faster. And it also brings into stark relief other things that could have been invented that are being slowed down by bureaucracy. We do about, Tyler Cowen has talked about the invisible graveyard and Alex Terabek too, the invisible graveyard. We do a bad job as human beings of calculating the costs of not just our indifference, but like our bureaucracy or our slowness or our, you got to respect the process. You don't want to disrupt things. You don't want to, you know, you don't want to take risk. Yeah. There's like, if you think about the people that could have been saved had the vaccines been greenlit a month earlier, or like I've talked about this before because I have young kids. We watched it play out with young kids in the vaccines where they're like, all right, the vaccines are approved. Well, we have a meeting scheduled for next month, so we'll address it then, right? Like the cost of not coming in the following weekend to deal with it quickly, there's an enormous cost to the future. The way we slow walk things or we're afraid of things, we cause a lot of death and suffering that way too.
I completely agree. And one of the things that I've been really excited to see come out of the effective altruist and long-termist community are just new projects that are trying to tackle some of this stuff. So, you know, we're particularly concerned about pandemics. We think that because of advances in biotechnology, there could be pandemics in our lifetime that kill many, many more people than COVID-19 did, could even lead to just the end of civilization, the end of the human race. And that's really worrying. And some people in the effective altruism community set up a company called Alvia, kind of part company, part nonprofit, as I understand it, developed the first Omicron BA2 specific vaccine in the world, and are setting up a system so that you can get very rapid detection, very rapid innovation in vaccines, where Pfizer and Moderna, it was, you know, within days maybe, that they used mRNA to create the first vaccines. So that you can do that, you have the regulatory setup already there, you have production capacity already in place, such that when the next pandemic hits, you are producing a vaccine against that within weeks rather than, you know, the 9 months that, we were waiting. And that's extremely exciting. And I think, again, this is the sort of thing that it won't happen unless, you know, altruistically minded people kind of get off their seats and try to make it happen. And the folks at Alvia, I think, really are. So.
I have a sign next to my desk. I wonder if you think about this something similar. I find myself in this strange position. It wasn't totally random, but there's a certain amount of luck and blessing in it, like where I am seen as the face of this thing, this 2,000-year-old philosophy, right? And so my rule is, am I being a good steward of Stoicism, right? So like, one, am I honoring it with the work that I do, but also the benefits that accrue from it, you know, where are those going, right? And I'm trying to think about where those going. Are they going to support different people? Am I paying people who work for me fairly? Am I investing it in more stuff that helps more people, et cetera? How do you think about, like, I was curious what you think of that idea of stewardship, because it strikes me as maybe an idea or a meme that would be more helpful in business. Like I had David Gills on the podcast, who wrote this book about Jack Welch, the CEO of GE, who basically comes in. It's one of America's oldest companies, its most successful companies. And he basically just sees it as numbers on a spreadsheet and he moves people around. He doesn't see it as being he doesn't see himself as being a steward of GE, this thing. He sees it as like a thing to optimize. I think stewardship is maybe a term that more leaders, politicians, and people should think about, even in the way in the U.S. we're stewards of this great democratic tradition. Are you making it better or worse? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I completely understand and empathize with that. It's interesting you talking about, you know, you being a face of stoicism and feeling a responsibility there, because, you know, I feel similarly with effective altruism, where I'm in this odd situation where I'm two things at once. One is an academic, and one thing academics do is just say, you know, whatever they want, just whatever they think. And I'm like always mainly do that, but I'm also aware, like, I am at the same time representing this wider movement. And
totally,
it's often a kind of tension I have to grapple with. But then on the question of stewardship for the world as a whole, yeah, absolutely. Just, you know, this is something that little c conservative thinkers have, you know, reflected on, Edmund Burke in particular, where, yeah, there's a thought of just, you look to the past and the benefits that people in the past have given you, you know, medicines, laws that are kind of built, and it's like a kind of gift, and it's not perfect. There are bad things too. It's just legacy of, you know, systemic racism, many problems in the kind of political system that we have too. But you take the thing and then you just try and, like, you know, make it better, pass it on to the next generation. I think that's a very inspiring idea. And then when you appreciate that, oh, this is a chain that might be very long indeed, where one of the metaphors I give in the book is of history as molten glass, where it can be blown into one of many shapes, could be deformed or could be beautiful. But the glass also shows how fragile it is as well, because, you know, there are risks we face in our lifetime of things that could just end civilization, you know, not just nuclear war, World War III, engineered pandemics, rogue AI could just destroy everything. And so you make me think of imagining the chain of generations, and they're just passing on this, like, this crystal that you're kind of, or this glass that you're changing. And you look behind you, there are thousands of people in this line behind you. You look ahead of you and you just can't even see because the line stretches so far.
Yes.
Do you pass it on, or do you just drop it, smash, civilization is gone?
Yes.
I think that really shows, like, you know, this is a huge responsibility we have to pass on a working civilization to, you know, the generations that are to come. Firstly, to pass on any civilization at all, which means avoiding all-out nuclear war. It means avoiding generation of a next round of, you know, next level of weapons of mass destruction, like engineered bioweapons. It means avoiding rise of kind of authoritarian ideologies that could try to take over the world, or extreme climate change that could massively harm civilization. Giving them a civilization at all, but then also just, yeah, trying to improve it, trying to make it better.
Technological,
but moral progress too.
You think about the fragile glass that is the peaceful transition of power in a democracy. And, like, one person can shatter it. And then you could argue you still have the ability to put it back together, to learn from it, to change. But you can only drop it so many times, right, before it's never possible to put back. And often you find people making very short-term calculations, like, hey, yeah, this guy's bad, he's going to do X, Y, and Z, but it will help me do X, right? It's these short-term trade-offs or corner cuttings or compromises that we make that come at the cost of those future generations. Like, I think you could argue the boomer generation is probably the quintessential generation that's made a number of sort of self-interested short-term changes to things that benefited them, but that have come at an immense cost to all future generations. And in some sense, that's probably the generation we can all learn from as to what not to be.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so easy to have, I mean, you know, take the issue of climate change, which is just one of the defining issues of our time. And, you know, something that has been amazing and very positive is the upsurge of moral concern about this, where perhaps one of the gifts we'll get from climate change, the silver lining to the, I wouldn't say cloud, but hurricane, is that there's now been this movement that's actually trying to stand up and be concerned about planetary scale effects and their impacts on future generations. And perhaps we can then generalize from that, seeing that, okay, yeah, it's not just climate change that impacts the future. Other catastrophic risks can too, nuclear war, engineered pathogens, failure of technological stagnation or moral stagnation. Those are grave risks too. And perhaps that means that, yeah, we can learn the lessons of the past and from here on forth have a culture that is not myopically concerned with benefits over the very short term, but really take seriously how what we're doing might impact centuries to come.
It is incredible to me, just because I've been reading a lot about him. In 1972, maybe, Jimmy Carter gave a speech to the entire country where he called climate change a moral equivalent to war. He put solar panels on the White House and said this was like the primary thing we needed to be focused on, not just energy independence, but a way of weaning ourselves off fossil fuels. And he knew this because he was a nuclear physicist. He worked on a nuclear submarine, right? And he saw what this was going. And people laughed at him. You know, they thought it was effeminate and stupid. And the first thing Ronald Reagan did when he came into the White House was remove the solar panels. And, you know, here we are 50 years later, just coming around to his advice, which I guess goes to the other point, which is you got to elongate your view of these things. And don't despair just because your message wasn't immediately well received in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, you firstly just got to love Jimmy Carter. What a hero. He's still out there just building homes. 90-something, I think. But yeah, one of the, again, the lessons I talk about in What We Are the Future very early on is the lesson from climate change science and activism. So people don't know this. People think, oh, we developed an understanding of climate change in the 60s and 70s. But the first quantitative estimate of the warming you get from carbon dioxide was in 1896 by Svante Arrhenius. And his estimate was actually pretty good. It was a little on the high side, but it's pretty close to the modern scientific consensus estimate. The idea of the greenhouse effect, that was early 20th century. In the 1950s, Frank Capra, one of the director of It's a Wonderful Life, had a documentary called Unchained Goddess that talked about the perils of climate change. And this was an area where response was very slow, actually. You know, it's only really the last few decades that we've seen sustained climate activism. We could have acted much, much earlier on. And if we had, we would have been acting on much more speculative evidence than we have now. And so maybe we would have been confused and actually climate change was never an issue. But we could have had a much larger impact much earlier on. The entrenchment of the fossil fuel industry, you could have had a plan that, you know, over the course of many decades, we'll invest much more in clean tech and introduce a carbon price and steered the entirety of the trajectory of the fossil fuel industry in a better direction. And I actually quote Bill McKibben, one of the world's leading environmentalists, who draws exactly this lesson, saying, from what I've learned from decades of work on climate activism, it shows we really need to be concerned about AI, which is just amazing for him to do, because he's saying, look, the thing you don't realize is that change happens very fast. We need to be attentive to trends as they're starting. And the trend in the, like, exponential, but like also a fast exponential progress in the power of AI systems, we are going to have to grapple with some really major ethical issues. Firstly, can we just make AI systems safe and under control? And then secondly, who gets to use them and with what power and how will this reshape society? And that's like, yeah, a lesson that I'm kind of trying to draw in What We Owe the Future in general is, look, climate change and environmental activism had this amazing moral insight and courage to stand up for future generations. What's everything that follows from that? Because it's not just an environmental issue. It's an issue that impacts many areas of technology, of politics, of moral reasoning.
Yeah. And I think the main message there is, you know, nip it in the bud early if you can.
Exactly. Yeah.
Will, this is amazing. I loved both books, but this new one especially. And thanks for all your work.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on, Ryan. It's been a real joy talking about these issues. And hopefully your audience inspired to go out and do some good in the world.
Yes, agreed. It's not that life is short, Seneca says. It's that we waste a lot of it. The practice of memento mori, the meditation on death, is one of the most powerful and eye-opening things that there is. We built this memento mori calendar for Daily Stoic to illustrate that exact idea, that your life, in the best case scenario, is 4,000 weeks. Are you going to let those weeks slip by, or are you going to seize them? The act of unrolling this calendar, putting it on your wall, and every single week that bubble is filled in, that black mark is marking it off forever. Have something to show, not just for your years, but for every single dot that you filled in, that you really lived that week, that you made something of it. You can check it out at dailystoic.com/mmcalendar. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.
Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.